You're listening to Innovation for Alpha, where we explore everything at the intersection of healthcare innovation and finance. Through our discussions and interviews, we keep you informed and educated about healthcare innovations, next-level venture investing, and everything involving the combination of the two.
Welcome, everybody. This is Tobin Arthur with the Innovation for Alpha podcast. And we have a really special guest today, Dr. Doug Jackson, who is the head of Project Cure based in Denver. But we're going to talk about the organization. I'm very excited, Dr. Jackson, to have you on the show today and just to get to know you a little bit more and to get to know the organization a little bit more. So welcome.
Thank you, Tobin. It's great to be here.
Let's start off with your background. Get everybody a sense of, you know, your career a little bit, and then we'll catch up to Project Cure.
Well, I like to tell people I'm the one guy most unqualified to do the job that I'm doing right now.
Perfect.
Yeah, I had originally intended to to be in law. Decided I when I was in the fourth grade I was going to be a judge, right? So I hurried up, got through law school, passed the bar at 23. Clerked for a judge and realized I don't want to be a judge. So I ended up in-house as a legal counsel for a big manufacturing company in Northern Indiana. And we manufactured big steel storage silos, automated feeding systems for turkeys and chickens and pigs. And we invented white plastic horse fence, you know. It was kind of a heady time, you know. 25-year-old kid. I had a Mercedes and a house on the lake and flying around in jets and all that stuff. And we got started buying up our competitors. And I was so young, they would actually leave me sitting in a hotel room next to a phone because they didn't want to bring in their 25-year-old lawyer, you know? And so I would just sit and I would just read and read and read. And I got really intrigued with the mergers and acquisitions deal. And so I decided to quit my nice job and go back and get a PhD in finance.
Wow.
And so that took me a fair amount of time, about 5-6 years and dissertation, and did a dissertation on leverage buyouts and secondary initial public offerings, right? And LPOs and SIPOs. Anyway, my dad, the reason we moved to Colorado, my dad came here basically to get rich. He was raised in Idaho as a poor kid, got into real estate, developed most of Winter Park and a little bit of Vail, and just got stupid rich and figured out that people can be really wealthy and have a lot of money and not be happy. And so my mom and dad started a foundation and they gave their money away. And then my dad started doing economic consulting. His first global consulting gig was with Robert Mugabe when Mugabe first became president of Zimbabwe. And he ended up in Peru and Ecuador and finally in Brazil working with President Sarney. Wow. And, you know, they had about a 3,800% inflation problem. So he was there and his interpreter was a medical student. And Lorena and her mom was a doctor. They would go into these favela clinics and they would help people. And they took my dad to see this clinic one time and it didn't have anything in it. And it just tore my dad's heart out. So he came back and told some friends, and one of his buddies had a medical wholesale company. And Greg filled my mom and dad's garage full of stuff, and they paid to ship that to Brazil. And that was the genesis of Project Cure.
Huh.
So I'm sitting there, you know, not even 29. I have 2 earned doctorate degrees. I'm talking to hedge fund groups and people like that. And my dad said, you should really give back. So I landed in San Diego teaching college for 5 years, thinking that was going to be my give back, living on Point Loma and looking out over the ocean every day, which, Tobin, that's not charity. That's not charity. That's just a really good life. But anyway, yes. I got kind of tired of academics. And so back to my dad, another conversation. Hey, I think I'm going back to New York, or talking to some guys on the options exchange in Chicago. Mm-hmm. And he said, I could really use some help with this Project Cure thing I started. And at the time, he had about a dozen volunteers. He had worked in roughly 30 countries around the world. He was shipping a load a month, and a load could be a couple pallets. It could be an x-ray machine. It could be a 20-foot container. It could be 40-foot, but he had something going out the door. We had this beat-up old warehouse next to a strip club on kind of the west side of Santa Fe and Evans there. And so, you know, no real money and no volunteers, but We thought we would help. So I grabbed two of my friends and the three of us went over. We got a $75,000 grant divided by three, divided by six. And we figured after 6 months, the money was going to run out and we'd have to go do something different. So that was 25 years ago.
Oh, wow.
My two friends got married and they moved away and I stayed. And so today, Project Cure, we've worked in 138 countries.
Holy smokes.
We have 30,000 volunteers every year. We're running somewhere in the neighborhood of 350,000 square feet of distribution center and another, I don't know, we're probably close to 100,000 square feet of collection center.
Holy cow.
We ship on average about four or five semi-truck trailers a day. A week.
Okay.
So about 200, 225 is what our goal is for this year. Semi-truck trailers out to places where people work for 12 hours a day and they make less than $5. And
so in many ways, you're really a logistics company. I mean, a complex logistics organization.
Yeah, we're truckers. And what we're trucking is everything from catheters to CAT scans.
Wow.
And move it around and changing completely, changing entire global healthcare systems, you know, and doing it in a way that's cost effective. I mean, you know, we talked a little bit about the finance, but when you think about it this way, I mean, we could be a capital company and we could be either loaning or, you know, equity investing in these places. And then they would go out and they would buy the equipment and, and you would ramp up. We just skip the cash and we give them the stuff directly. And and the goal is, of course, and in my opinion, every nonprofit should have this goal. And I'm not talking about hospitals, museums, or universities, but every other nonprofit should have the goal of you should work hard to put yourself out of business.
Like it.
Because if you're not doing that, you're not really attacking the root cause. You're treating symptoms, right?
Right. You're just treading water.
Exactly. So we go into these engagements and we just tell the people, my happiest day is when you look at me and tell me, thank you. This has been great. I don't need you anymore. And if we can get to that point with these people around the world, then we know we've done our job. Now, it may take a long, long time. And I've sat in conference rooms in places like, you know, Nigeria, and I say that and they just all start laughing, you know, but that really is what we're trying to do is to get them to a place where they can create sustainable healthcare in their communities for the people that really need it. The problem is that the capital acquisition cost to get there is just too high.
That's incredible. I mean, I don't even know where to start. There's so much there, but let's unpack a few things. Actually, let's start with just some logistics. So how many cities in the U.S., and I assume U.S. is the primary source of, but correct me if that's wrong, and how many cities do you operate out of? And just give us a little sense of that supply chain. How does it work? Where it comes in, and then how do you bundling and shipping back out?
Yeah, we are just in the United States. We tried to do this we have a license in the UK.
Okay.
We were working with a member of the House of Parliament in Norway because, you know, NORAID is a pretty good organization. What we discovered, Tobin, is that there's really not the same level of volunteer engagement in other cities. And we are so volunteer driven, you know, we're only 35 staff with 30,000 volunteers. So there's about 1,000 volunteers per paid staff at this organization.
It's amazing.
And that really is, I don't know if you'd call it a secret sauce, but there are not a lot of organizations that can do that, right?
Yeah, that's incredible.
So and then when you get a socialized healthcare system, technically all that equipment belongs to the state. And so like even Canada, you know, there's this long process that they have to go through to make it available to the First Nations tribes. And then it has to sit in a warehouse and every other, you know, smaller facility gets to bid on it. And then it has to be put up for auction. And then if none of that happens, then, you know, they can give it away. Well, a decade has gone by and now you don't want it anyway, because it's been sitting in a warehouse for 10 years. And and it was used to start with. So we've just had a really, you know, deep commitment to the United States. So here in the U.S., we are in seven cities. So it's Denver. The next one we open is Phoenix, Nashville, Houston, Chicago, Philadelphia. And then, as if COVID wasn't enough of a challenge, we opened our seventh warehouse in Kansas City in 2020.
Well, right? And no surprise, I'm guessing one of the themes there is those are all big healthcare cities.
You know, I had this student, I love interns, especially at the university level, because they're just energetic, idealistic. You know, they think about things in a fun way. I had this intern and her boyfriend worked for a big organization that had a massive mainframe.
Okay.
And somewhere Nicole got a hold of these CDs with hospitals, manufacturers, and wholesalers. And she took them over to her boyfriend's work one weekend. And they loaded all this information on this computer. And they printed out this map. And she came in just breathless on a Monday afternoon. She said, "Dr. Jackson, I just plotted healthcare in America." And I'm like, "What do you mean?" She unfolds this map on the conference table. And here's Houston. Houston bleeds through black ink all the way through the back of the map, right?
Sure. There's
so many places in Houston.
Yeah.
Memorial Hermann has 38 hospitals by itself. There's like 150 hospitals in Houston.
It's the major leagues down there for sure. When I first went down there, people had talked about Houston forever. Until you go see the medical center, it's just, you can't even fathom what's going on there.
Oh, yeah. No, it's crazy. Then you get cities like, you know, Dallas or Chicago. They've got like 85 hospitals in there. There's, I think, 52 hospitals on the island of Manhattan. Kind of work your way down. The 25th city on that list was Denver. Hmm. And I thought, if we can do this well in Denver, we can do it better in 24 other places across the country. So, you know, Nashville, we're there, not because they have a lot of hospitals, but 75% of all healthcare in America is headquartered in Nashville, Tennessee.
That's right. That's
a bigger industry than country music.
Yeah.
So we're there. And, you know, the goal of ultimately is to get 25 of these. And if we could do that, we could end up, you know, a warehouse running at capacity will run about 50 semi-truck trailers a year. So about one a week.
Okay.
Is a good pace for us because you got to procure it. You got to clean it up, fix the equipment, sort the supplies, load the container. So if you do about one a week, that's good. And that's in 50,000 square feet, right? So we're 50,000 square feet, rack three high.
Okay.
So quick math, if you got 25 of these, that's 1,250 containers a year, which is about, there's 125 developing countries plus or minus around the world. So that'll give you an idea of what we could do in perpetuity for every developing country in the world.
That's unbelievable. So back into that, to that container load, what does it include potentially and what does it not include?
Yeah. So each one of these containers is completely custom. And that's one of those things that, you know, for me, I would just expect that would be like, you know, falling off the back of the wagon. It's just, of course it has to be, because you can't just blindly assume that every hospital is like the other hospital.
Right.
But there's a lot of NGOs that do that. So every one of our loads starts with a needs assessment. And that means somebody from Project Cure actually straps in a plane, flies over, goes boots on the ground in the hospital. We sit down with the doctors and nurses. We go through about 18 pages of pretty in-depth questions, starting big, like what's your catchment area, down to how many surgeons do you have and what procedures do they practice, the specialties, how many babies are born here, what's your cesarean rate? I mean, all that stuff.
Wow.
And then we physically go room to room through the hospital. You know, we start with the ER, you know, do you guys need gurneys? Do you need crash carts? Do you need EKGs? Do you need defibs? Do you need, you know, trachs and all of this stuff. And we're doing that with the supplies too. So by the time we're done, and then we take pictures of every room in the hospital. So by the time we're done, we've got a really good framework for exactly what that hospital needs. And that's what determines what goes on that container.
Interesting. So, okay. So back at the warehouse, are you accumulating materials all the time? And then you come back with, let's just call it the shopping list.
Yep.
And then you determine, you know, what you have on hand, maybe what's missing, and there's maybe a gap analysis. I mean, is that kind of what takes place?
That's exactly right. Yeah. Okay. And we talk about the fact we build our birthday cake from the candles down.
Okay.
So a candle would be anesthesia machines. It's ultrasounds. It's ventilators. It's, you know, the high-end stuff that, you know, all different kinds of really expensive equipment.
Yeah.
And then around that, then you build the beds and, you know, all of those things, the stainless and everything that you need, maybe, kick buckets and suction and all of that. And then around that, then you build all of the gloves and gauze and needles and syringes, suture, IV starting kits. We don't do hardly any pharma.
Okay.
A little bit. There's some great organizations, you know, cousins, sisters, whatever you want to call it, in the industry that do really, really well with pharma. And so we kind of tag up with them sometimes. And they'll put, but that's a whole different game with cold chain and all of that. It's just, you got to fly it. We've learned with Ukraine that flying things is a whole different conversation than shipping it on a freight container.
Yeah, I want to get to that here in a second. By the way, so one of my really good friends and former colleague, he's a great healthcare guy. He was the head of global strategy at GE Healthcare and at one point head of global strategy at Microsoft Healthcare. But very beginning of his career, he worked in ventilation. And so a couple of years ago when COVID broke out, he and some of his former colleagues, many of whom are retired or close to retiring, got to talking and they thought, there's a lot of ventilators sitting in the basements of hospitals doing nothing. And so they created a nonprofit almost overnight to go in and refurbish, and they get donations. I think the Walton family and others put money in. White House got involved very quickly. And they pulled a lot of ventilators out of non-circulation and got them back into the market. And they knew, there would be a point where the needs would begin to diminish and so it wasn't set up to be a long-term organization, but it was fascinating to watch that and just see how, everybody else was scrambling to try to figure out how to build new ventilators and and they thought there's plenty out there. I just need to get them back in circulation.
Well, and I appreciate that story a lot for two reasons. One, we were actually shipping ventilators out to little hospitals through rural Colorado, Kansas, places like that, because they didn't have any. University of Colorado at Anschutz, I think, got 12 of them from us. Mm-hmm. But there was an article in the New York Times when COVID had first started about the number of ventilators in different countries around the world. And Nigeria had, and I'm just going by memory, but somewhere around 120. Mm-hmm. And of those, I could account for the fact that we had put about 80 of those into country.
Wow. That's pretty incredible.
Not wild.
Well, it was interesting, speaking of these other countries too, I remember, so as the U.S. was starting to decline a little bit in need, Brazil, I think, was a place where they were spiking and they were needing, and it was incredible. So these guys had inventory, and the red tape that was thrown up in front of them at all fronts, in the other countries, even here to some extent, there was issues around competitive companies. I'm thinking competitive companies. These aren't even in circulation anymore. Right. But invariably, some of these countries just didn't get them because the red tape was so extensive. It was astonishing. Let's talk about Ukraine. So you mentioned Ukraine. Obviously, it's been an unbelievable story. These people are going through a lot. Talk about your involvement there.
So we started working in Ukraine about 1994. This was before I came on a Project Cure. Okay. When the Soviet Union came apart, we got calls from, Rotary, for example, saying, hey, we've got a sister club in Tver, Russia. Could you come over and do something? My dad would get on a plane, he'd fly over there. And he got a call from Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia, and Ukraine. So that got him over there. We got together with, a bunch of partners. Everything we do is always with a partner, right? So somebody invites us to come over there. So we had some partners. There's a doctor in Nashville, a guy named Brian McMurray, and he had adopted a hospital in Vinnytsia. So he called, and my dad went over in 96 with Brian. Anyway, I think we had already put about $20 million worth of medical relief into Ukraine. And the Russians didn't leave them with great stuff anyway.
Now they're surprised.
Destroyed everything else. So we had a pretty good footprint. We knew a lot of people over there. We were good at what we do and figuring out how to work in disaster situations. We had spent most of the beginning of the year actually doing the same thing in the northern part of Ethiopia because of the Tigray conflict.
Wow.
And there, you got 250,000 people have been, killed or displaced in what, by all admissions, is a civil war. Pretty sad.
Right.
We were working there anyhow. And then, 24th of February comes along and Putin goes in and people started coming out and the stories were horrible. Mm-hmm. And we had a container that was ready to go in our warehouse in Phoenix. And so we went to ship that container, and the shipping company called and said, the port of Odessa is closed. We're not coming to pick up your container. And so I got a hold of, we called the staff together and we talked about it. The news came out in Phoenix. I was there. We did some news reports with Ruth and the team in Phoenix, and that went national. So that first weekend, we had like 4,000 people log on to make donations.
Wow.
Some of those were from Russia, actually, giving money,
wow,
Project Cure, to help in Ukraine.
That's incredible.
Then we started getting calls and calls and calls and calls. And, you know, there's the Coloradoans for the Ukraine project, and there's this project and that project, a big group in Chicago. And there's a neat organization called AirLink, and Steve Smith's a good friend and he runs AirLink. And so Steve got on the phone and started, you know, helping us work space available. Flexport, good people there. Ryan has a 501c3 that he has that runs alongside of his for-profit logistics company. He did a lot of work during COVID with Seco, S-E-K-O, the shipping freight line company.
Yep.
So we just reached out and tapped our partners and started shipping. And I think as of today, wow, probably done around 40 airlifts into Ukraine.
Holy cow.
2 weeks ago, two weekends ago, we chartered a Airbus A330, so 777 size cargo plane. So that's about 8 semi-truck trailers in that one aircraft.
And wow,
we had a very generous donor just write us $250,000 check. And we paid to ship that over. That's about what it costs to charter a freight plane like that.
Holy cow. So
we got that over there. And, a lot of that's going into Poland. Some of it's going into Germany. And then we've been able to find organizations like Seco and Flexport and people like that who can actually pick it up and get it trucked into the front lines in Ukraine. There's a group of people that we're working with that come over and get our cure kits. These are about $2,000 of medical stuff, emergency stuff that's packed in 50-pound, bags, duffel bags. They were carrying it into Mariupol during the siege. I mean, the people who have stepped up in this crisis have just been unbelievable.
That's
in
cool.
In a good way.
I wonder about, as you're describing the situation a little bit, and I'm curious about the kind of what you see in terms of the status quo. Are things stabilizing at all, or is it it's hard to say where this goes? They just continually need, what would be your take on it at the moment?
Well, interestingly, it's getting worse, not better.
Okay.
I think Russia has decided to focus on the Donbass region. And, one of the things that that's interesting, we don't really think a lot about this, but this history goes back a long, long time.
Yeah.
And, World War II, there was a lot of conflict in the Ukraine, and the Germans got within 8 miles of Moscow. Mm-hmm. Of the 8.5 million people who starved to death in 1948, 6 million of those were Ukrainians. Mm. It's been a really tough place, and then they gave up all their weapons in 1994 with a promise that the world would protect them if Russia came in. And in
right.
2014, they lost Crimea and nobody did anything.
Right.
So you can kind of see sort of where this is headed. And unfortunately, I was reading something this last weekend. More people watched the Johnny Depp trial than tuned in to Ukrainian news last week.
Unbelievable.
So we're not seeing that much of the news, but the truth is that over there it's getting worse. And the stories we're hearing about are more desperate than they were even, 50 days ago. And, I'm concerned, that people are just going to say, oh, well, that happened, and we brush our hands and we walk away and stop paying attention. But, what I've seen is that we're probably looking at 9 months to a year more. And I don't know what those people are going to do.
It's a long haul. And as supply chains are cut off and things start to diminish, I mean, you got to imagine it. Everything just gets worse.
Right.
Talk a little bit about the logistics of security. So people getting things into markets like this, you know, you mentioned these are some conflict markets. Is that ever a factor that you guys have to deal with, or are your partners having to deal with that more because they're the front lines, or how does that factor into your operations?
I like to say we only have to deal with that on days that end in a Y. it's hard everywhere. And even, you know, we do a lot of work in other places. And that's the interesting thing about this thing with the Ukraine is we haven't stopped working in the other countries. So we're still shipping into Nigeria and Ethiopia and Mexico and, you know, places like that. Mm. We put about 500,000 needles and syringes into Cuba during COVID, right?
Wow.
We're working in places like that. Anyway, even in some places like Mexico, you know, when they elected López Obrador, it completely changes all the rules and regulations and who you're going to work with. And that ought to be easy. We've done 125 semi-truck trailers into Mexico. We're the largest relief provider in Mexico, period.
Wow.
Well, it shut us down for about 18 months so we could figure out how to get around the regulations and, you know, work with the new administration. And that's our next door neighbor, right?
Yeah.
So then you get into places where, you know, Mali, right? Timbuktu, Mali. There is a city, by the way, called Timbuktu. And Bamako and places like that. Well, then, you know, they have a coup, or Burkina Faso, or, you know, all these places that we've been working in. And things change, and it's for a lot of different reasons. You know, when President Kenyatta came into Kenya, he started dealing with corruption. Well, I guess that impacts any of us that are trying to import anything, including charity work. And so we had to kind of figure out how to support his efforts to reduce corruption. We don't want to be seen as an organization that, you know, promises it's going to be used for charity and then you go sell it. And there are organizations that do that. And they just want to avoid the import tax. So you got to support the effort, but you still got to figure out how to make it work, because I'm not going to pay taxes on stuff we're going to donate. That doesn't make any sense.
Well, on that front, you know, you hear stories, and I wonder how much you guys have any exposure to this or risk of this. So, you know, do you have issues where there's bandits and people that do want to take these supplies and turn around and try to sell them, or hold people ransom to get them, or whatever? I mean, use them in some nefarious way that obviously is what was unintended. Is that ever a factor?
Well, we try to pay attention to that. I mentioned the needs assessment. I like to say that when we go on needs assessments, we're looking for the three C's, right? And the first one is character. Do you really trust your partners? And the only way I know to do that is you got to go there. I mean, Zoom and Skype and all that stuff is fine, but I don't really get a sense of who you are until we sit down and I can see your body language. You take a look at the office. I see how you treat your staff. You know, if I go to a hospital and the hospital administrator doesn't want any staff around when we're having a conversation, that's a big red flag to me.
Interesting.
Because he doesn't want any peer pressure. He wants zero accountability.
Yeah.
I want the hospital administrator that wants to be accountable, right?
Yeah.
So character is one. Capacity is another one. If we get this stuff over here, can you use it? Do you have electricity? Do you have training? Can you fix it? You know, all those things. And then customs is the third one. Can you actually get it through customs and then the other thing that we do that's a little bit different, Tobin, is we don't ship to warehouses.
Okay.
I mean, like I said, we're running around 500,000 square feet of warehouse all in. I hate warehouses. They're expensive. That's where stuff gets dropped and broken and lost and stolen. And so we would rather ship that container and put that thing right up against the door of the hospital and unload it directly to the hospital. And the people who are unloading it are the nurses and the doctors that we just did the needs assessment with. They have a passion to cure people, not... Are there bad apples? Yeah, probably. Sure. But, you know, I see people running around with surgical scrubs, and it's like, I'll bet you that hospital didn't sell those to you. That stole your scrubs, you know.
Yeah.
But anyway, it happens sometimes. But No, if you do your best to try to do that up front, then you're not scrambling on the back end.
Yeah. Let's turn a little bit to people listening that might be able to contribute in some form. So as you know, our audience is a lot of doctors, a lot of investors and folks of that type, and then other stakeholders throughout the industry. So what are the needs of the group as you're operating today? I mean, obviously, money's got to always be an issue. You need donations, but expand a little bit on what's the constant need.
Well, we have to keep three plates turning at the same time to make this work.
Okay.
One of those plates is the procurement, right? So we're out there all the time. We've got our teams in the seven cities, and I like to say that they're hunting with a shotgun. They'll just take anything people will give us.
Okay.
So we'll go over to a hospital, in town here, and we just load up, and we're taking all of the extras that are coming out of the procedure rooms. We're taking the, equipment, this, that, whatever. And we do that in all those cities. And then we've got people on the team who, hunt with a rifle. So these are the folks that are going to go to our friends at Welsh Allyn, and we end up getting, 4,500 intertemporal thermometers, brand new, in the box with the Band-Aids, with the batteries. Stryker, at the end of COVID, had manufactured a bunch of beds that were manual beds, brand new mattresses and stuff. Well, we didn't need them, which was the right answer. So they called and they said, hey, could you use these manual beds? And it's like, yeah. And almost every country that didn't have electricity, perfect.
Wow.
And they said, okay, we'd like to give them to you. I said, well, how many do you have? And Liz said, 22,500 beds.
Holy crap.
So we spent the better part of 18 months moving beds around the world. You can put 100 beds in a semi-truck trailer. And these are brand new. They're still broken down, but it's got wheels. It's got an IV pole, a headboard, a footboard. They articulate so you can ventilate. Anyway.
That's unbelievable.
We did the same thing with Health Trust a few years ago with Hill-Rom, and we ended up with like 2,500 Advantics. These things are $15,000 electric beds. So we're going after really specific stuff. So, let's say that you've got a situation where, and we've seen this happen in Denver, with the urology practices, with the orthopedic practices, our friends down the road at Stedman, when they join a group, they get an infusion of capital. Well, a lot of times that's even things like, hey, let's replace all the exam tables so that it all matches.
Yep.
Right. I don't want to use Dr. Tobin's, gray because I'm tan. Right.
Right.
So there's that. They replace equipment. They start ASCs, ambulatory surgical centers, and they got all of this stuff. Well, that generates a lot of excess product. Mm. We would love to get in front of that.
Okay.
And have that conversation. Even if it's them talking to the company, they can say, hey, what are you doing for, Project Cure these days? So all of that product, the excess that comes out of that is really important to us.
Okay.
But that's the procurement side. That's one plate we have to spin. And anything like that that's coming out of a medical center or, working with a manufacturer on a trade-in or anything like that, we want all of that.
Okay.
I'm trying to figure out, I really want to get a case study. A lot of the CFOs in hospitals will say, oh, well, just put all the old stuff up for auction. Well, I can tell you from 25 years of doing this, that you're going to spend a lot of money on things like warehousing and time. You're working the guys down on the supply docks and things. And that money doesn't get accounted toward the, price of what you made by selling it at 10 cents on the dollar to an auction. Give it to us first. We can generate a profitable tax consequence. We can help with, the ACA. And your philanthropic give back dollars. I mean, there's a lot of things that we can do to work with them. So anyway, enough on procurement. Volunteers is a super huge thing for us.
Okay.
Nurses and doctors are great. We'll get, yesterday we had a big bank and a big law firm that came in. Bankers and lawyers don't know that much about yank arrow tips and suction, but nurses and doctors do. And so we really need them as coaches, people to be there so that people like myself that are, you know, finance and law people, we can actually be productive while we're working here. So that's cool. They could scrub in with us on clinics, and maybe we can talk about that before we're done. Mm-hmm. Where we actually take doctors and nurses overseas, and we sit shoulder to shoulder, and we do the work, right?
Oh, wow.
And so that's a neat thing. And then the other thing is, you know, you brought it up, and the third plate is the money. And that's the part that we have to spend. And I know that, you know, with all of the activity around, you know, private equity and the mergers, and it's just, I mean, billions of dollars of dry powder chasing medical right now.
Yep.
That creates some interesting tax consequences for some of our doctor friends that are like, man, I don't want to give, you know, 40% away to the government. I need to start a DAF or a family fund or something like that. Where would I give it that I know that it's going to be taken care of well, that it's going to do something that's near and dear to my heart, and maybe I could actually go see what I just did with my donation. And so we're working with a lot of folks right now that are in that situation and saying, hey, you know, this makes a lot of sense. And so kind of keeping it in the family.
Yep.
Yeah.
Love it. What, just curious on a rough percentage basis, how much of the inflow of capital comes from individual donations versus, say, larger either foundations or family offices or what have you?
Yeah, well, overall, we're about a third. So about a third of what we do comes from working with other NGOs or directly with governments, right? About a third comes from working with big corporations, you know, Newmonts and Chevrons and Exxons and people like that. And then the other third is, you know, Rotary clubs, foundations, individuals, things like that. Foundation giving is probably our overall budget would be less than 10%, honestly.
Okay.
A lot of foundations, in fact, most of the foundations in Colorado that got started, you know, back in the 1850s to the 1950s, the donors were concerned about life in a 5-county range along the Front Range of Colorado, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the Gates Rubber family and the Betchers and the Bonfies, very, very generous. But the last thing they were thinking about is people living in the middle of Africa or Latin America, right, or Asia. So we don't qualify for those grants.
Mm.
And it's great. They're still doing good stuff. And I live in this town. I want them to do really good stuff in this town. But it makes it hard for an organization like Project Cure because we're international.
Mm-hmm. Going back to the cities where you're located. So for those not in those cities, at least not yet. So money is always is helpful. Are there other ways that they can contribute? So, for example, if I'm running a hospital system and I'm not in one of the six cities that you're currently, is there a way for us to get you materials, or is it just logistically too challenging?
No, if we've got we'll figure it out, particularly if it's, you know, somebody calls with 5 ultrasound machines in Las Vegas tomorrow, we're going to go get them.
Okay.
figure out how to do it. We've had a great relationship with Walmart over the years. And now with the news that they bought the Broncos yesterday, I'm even a bigger fan. but, you know, they'll go with what they call an LTL, a less than a load.
Okay.
And they'll haul stuff all over. Jake Jabs here in Denver, you know, with American Furniture Warehouse, that guy will go 350, 400 miles out of his way and pick stuff up and bring it back.
Oh, wow. That's cool.
Yeah. So, you know, it's not that it's an infinite resource, but we do have ways that we can get things moved around.
Okay.
And if somebody, you know, I'm talking to a group in Dallas right now who really want to start in the way that we start, you know, the way we start in Kansas City, we started small.
Mm.
And it grew. And so we decided at some point that, you know, we were partnering with the Franciscan Mission Warehouse, and we decided, hey, let's really make a big play on this. Dallas, I would anticipate, you know, if we start with a little collection center at some point, you got to do it. We're looking very seriously at starting another one, either Sarasota or probably Orlando, Florida.
Okay.
We had a retired doctor and his wife, she was a nurse, and they started collecting. We were shipping a semi-truck trailer out of Florida almost every month.
Hmm.
Just on the retired community and what they were doing. So that tells me there's probably a market there.
Yeah.
We need to, you know, pull together a 50,000 square foot warehouse and get started.
Yep. No doubt about it. Well, Doug, I there's so many more things we can talk about, and I want to keep this channel, the podcast, as well as our other channels at Angel and D, as an open tool. We'll figure out ways to continue to, you know, increase the support for Project Cure. I think our network is perfect to plug in. And so I'm extremely excited that we got to know you. This is a great mission that you and your father before you have nurtured. It's amazing. I mean, I don't even know where to start. So a lot more to come, but I really appreciate a chance getting to know you today. And we'll be looking for things that we can do to help keep pushing you to the next level and support whatever you're doing.
That's neat, man. The honor has been mine to be with you. And congratulations on building a very, very cool network. I mean, that's really where it's at is pulling us all together and focusing on an aligned mission and a bigger cause, right?
Yeah, that's right. So we have an internal phrase we use: innovation is social. But the broader term we use is that we're all smarter and more efficient together than we are individually. And so I think that certainly applies to what you're doing on a global scale and a scale that most of us don't fathom. So thanks so much.
Thanks, my friend.
See you again soon for the next episode of Innovation for Alpha. Make sure to go to Innovation for Alpha for access to prior episode links, show notes, and other valuable resources. This show is for entertainment purposes only. Before making any investment decisions, please consult with a professional. This show is copyrighted by Angel Indie Media, and written permission must be granted before syndication or rebroadcasting.